The second case for oral argument this morning is Stephen B. Schwartz, M.D., appellant versus Patricia Costell, appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Lonnie Braun, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, we have Mr. G. Vern Goodsell and Terrence Clinton, attorneys from Rapid City. Mr. Goodsell, I understand you'll be presenting the argument this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Justices Sabers and Konenkamp have disqualified themselves from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, presiding judge for the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in behalf of Justice Sabers' place, and has appointed the Honorable Douglas Hoffman, circuit judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in place of Justice Konenkamp. Mr. Braun, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Pardon the cough drop, but I'll start hacking if I don't put one in. I've got one that I just can't get rid of.
Well, we were handing them out before we just came in the back room. So.
Right.
Do you want water up there?
I've got it right here. But
I'll take it to the podium if you want.
I'll spill it over there. I've got to keep it there, Judge. Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I am Lonnie Braun from Rapid City, and I'm here representing Dr. Steve Schwartz in his clinic. In the claim brought against him by Ms. Costell. We're here seeking a new trial, reversal of a jury verdict, on the basis that Dr. Schwartz did not receive a fair trial. Instructions were given that were improper and prejudicial to his case, and evidence was admitted and not admitted that was prejudicial to Dr. Schwartz being able to present his case. As much as we can, we're going to go through each of those issues in the time that we have here this morning, understanding that I'm going to try to cover at least the new trial issues first. Dr. Schwartz is a neurosurgeon, came to Rapid City and practiced for about a year. After that time, he was enticed, or he was offered a job by his competitor, Dr. Tuber, and he turned it down. After that, the record became pretty clear that Dr. Tuber began complaining to the medical board, the hospital's patients, families, and other people about Dr. Tuber's opinion of Dr. Schwartz's care. Spawned a lot of litigation. Before things settled down, there were over 30 cases pending against Dr. Schwartz. Four of them have been tried. The one you're hearing this morning is the fourth of the jury trials against Dr. Schwartz. The other three were all defense verdicts. One of them will be the next argument. The other two were not appealed. Besides that, over 20 of the other cases either counsel withdrew or they were voluntarily dismissed as this action proceeded. What brought Ms. Costell here? She was a patient of Dr. Schwartz's. She saw him for a second opinion concerning back pain that was becoming debilitating. Dr. Schwartz's first impression was that she needed a one-level fusion. He recommended that to her, and she consented. She likewise consented for him to do any additional procedures that he deemed necessary because sometimes things are found in an operation that need to be taken care of. Four experts were designated by counsel against Dr. Schwartz. One of them was Dr. Tuber, who had testified in two of the other actions. Dr. Tuber ultimately was not called as a witness in the case. Although Dr. Schleusner was called, he was in a different clinic, but in a business relationship with Dr. Tuber. Ms. Costell had her surgery. In the course of the operation, additional pathology was found. We're talking about the low back surgery, and it had been planned that she would have a fusion at L4-5. On entering her back, Dr. Schwartz found additional pathology at L3-4. And additional pathology at L5-S1. In his discretion, he did a fusion of all three of those levels, the third one after consulting with the family of Ms. Costell out in the hall. Within about a month, Ms. Costell was getting better. She'd had a major operation, but she was coming along. She was back to work part-time, and then she received her anonymous letter. the anonymous letter told her that something terrible had happened to her, gave her an ad from a malpractice lawyer, suggested that she see the lawyer, and that something was going to be covered up. Not too long after that, Ms. Kostel appropriately consulted with counsel. This lawsuit was brought, and ultimately we tried it to the jury. This court has to decide whether Dr. Schwartz received a fair trial. I'm going to try to start with the issues that to me seem the clearest on the reversible error and the prejudice to Dr. Schwartz, and I would start with the court's instruction number 13. It is not the first issue briefed, but it is the one that says you must decide whether Dr. Schwartz possessed and used the knowledge, skill, and care which the law demands based on the testimony and evidence of members of the profession who testified as expert witnesses. As we indicated in our briefs, we objected. That is precisely the instruction that was given in the Magba Hut case and questioned by Attorney Wallahan on a case that was tried by my then partner, Mr. Porter. Mr. Wallahan was indicating, and that was a bad baby case, but he was indicating that there were nurses who saw things and knew what they had seen. There were patients' family who saw things in the delivery of this baby, and that it was relevant to the issue of the standard of care, that this testimony be considered. And that caused the pattern jury committee to approve the additional language that lay witnesses are entitled to have their testimony considered on standard of care issues, on things that appropriately they would be able to observe.
But Mr. Brown, let me ask you a question right away.
Certainly, Jeff.
On this, I didn't see anything in the briefs that suggested that either the physician's assistant or the nurse practitioner were prevented from telling the jury that they also observed pathology at the other level, and that what was the other issue about the whether the bone graft was actually done at another level. As I understand the record, correct me if I'm wrong, they were able to tell the jury their views supporting Dr. Schwartz on that.
What they were able to do, Justice Zinner,
their observations, I should say.
And my issue is not that they weren't able to tell the jury what they observed, any more than the nurses and the parents in Magba Hut were allowed to tell the jury what they saw and heard. The issue comes down to the jury being told, on a standard of care basis, there's only one thing that you can consider, and that's the testimony of the expert witnesses who are testifying as spine surgeons. And that was the precise preclusion that this court found was reversible and prejudicial error, because there were observations. As you noted from our brief, one of the critical issues in this case is whether there was even any pathology at 3-4, at L3, L4. The PA, Sieg, was standing at Dr. Schwartz's shoulder looking in the open back, and he testified to Dr. Schwartz using an instrument to spread the vertebrae apart, and even talking to a medical student who was there and demonstrating that this was there. And the jury was told by the court that they could not consider that as evidence of compliance with the standard of care because Judge Fuller refused the instruction.
But the jury wasn't really told they couldn't consider these two people's testimony.
The two people were not named, and they were not told you can't consider these two people on the standard of care. But what the jury was told, that on issues of standard of care, you can only consider the people that are here testifying as spine surgeons. And that's the portion that is the same issue that arose in Magba Hut. It was prejudicial error, and for the jury not to be instructed that on lay witnesses or other people, that they are entitled in deciding whether Dr. Schwartz met the standard of care to look at the issue of whoever can see whatever they can see as far as what was done.
So they didn't testify to any opinions? Is that what you're saying?
You're asking me whether now you're talking about the two mid-levels?
Right, right.
The two mid-levels were not permitted to give any neurosurgical opinions. And again, that's not our complaint, Justice Meyer Henry. They were permitted to talk from the perspective of, we are here, we are seeing things that are going on, we are talking to this patient. And an important person that we can't leave out of this equation, of course, we'll get to the issue of how limited Dr. Schwartz was allowed to testify in talking about himself. But this prevented the jury from accepting his testimony on what he said, I saw and did. Dr. Schwartz never did talk about standard care, and I'm not suggesting that he did, but he did have his observations and testimony, and that instruction in this case was particularly prejudicial because it didn't allow the jury to consider any of the defense witnesses with the exception of the retained expert who was not there at the time of the surgery or at the time of the care of Ms. Costa.
We can't spend too much time on this issue, but These witnesses were never asked to express an opinion on standard of care.
I'm sorry?
These witnesses were never asked to express an opinion on standard of care for Dr. Schwartz anyway.
No, and they would not have.
So what difference does the instruction make?
Well, it makes a difference, and it's the same difference that was made in the Magbahut case, except for the other side, Justice Zinner. And that is that the jury, in getting their instructions, has to be instructed appropriately. And they are told how to treat evidence. And in this case, they were told that they could only consider the testimony of people who testified as expert witnesses on the issue of the standard of care of Dr. Schwartz. It became particularly more egregious since the pattern instruction had been changed to pick up Magbahut and the fact that there was so much non-neurosurgical spine expert testimony that was involved in the observations in the case. Another instruction that was not given in this case was a general instruction on how to judge the credibility of witnesses. Dr. Schwartz proposed one. Obviously, there were a lot of credibility issues after a week and a half trial and people vehemently disagreeing with things. This court in Frazier in 1983 talked with approval about the instruction on determining the credit to be given any witness. You can take into account the witness's ability and opportunity to observe, remember the witnesses, or remember the witness's manner while testifying, any interest or bias or prejudice the witness may have, and the reasonableness of the witness's testimony in light of all, in light of all of the testimony.
But the jurors don't shut their common sense at the door. I mean, we do that every day in all of our relations and discussions with people. We make those kinds of evaluations. Can't we assume that the jury did the same thing in that jury room?
Do we
have to define everything?
Well, we should define the important things, and particularly when it is the role of the juror in this particular case, Chief Justice. I mean, the problem with sitting there and saying, you're the judge of the credibility, and we give them absolutely no factors.
Did the judge say why that instruction was not given?
He didn't like it.
Okay. But it's still part of the pattern jury instructions, is it not?
It is. I mean, the quote that I just read you is almost, I mean, it's this court's language in the Frazier case, but it is almost verbatim the pattern instruction. The judge did not like that instruction. And my problem, and the prejudice that comes up in this kind of a case, is suppose we have a juror sitting there and we haven't given them the factors and they simply say, I don't think women are as honest as men. I mean, that's an unfair factor. It's important for the court to tell the jury, here are the things for you to consider. Because we tell them not to use prejudice or anything else, but there are things that the jury has to do in evaluating the evidence and trying to determine, you know, what they're going to do with it. And this instruction should have been given. It was not in Dr. Schwartz's prejudice by its exclusion.
Were there any witnesses that testified differently at trial than they had in a deposition or anything like that?
You know, the other side raises an issue that Dr. Schwartz did, Justice Meyer Henry, and frankly, his answer was not precisely what it had been at his deposition. However, what had occurred was Dr. Schwartz was present when the judge was very adamant on, we're not going to get into a Dr. Tuber battle in the middle of this thing. And they asked a precise question that Dr. Schwartz had answered in a deposition where he included some knowledge of what Dr. Tuber had been up to with this lady's records.
Was there a special instruction about any of that, about if a witness testifies differently in out of court or anything like that?
I don't recall that one.
Or any admonition to the jury or any direction on how to consider that?
I mean, the problem was is we had the one statement, the simple statement, and it's in my brief, of you are the sole judges. But then we gave a falsus in uno instruction. And to me, without the direction on what are you going to do with this other evidence, and then we have a falsus in uno instruction, the jury was basically told you either throw it all out or it's all gospel. And the factors were never provided to them.
Did the other side take some unfair advantage of this gap in the instructions?
The unfair advantage came to Dr. Schwartz being deprived of an instruction that he was entitled to. You know, this court looked at the standard. It was just in beef. Sorry, it was in Happy, the two cases, but the last two cases, the malpractice cases that this court decided. And you indicated that no court has the discretion to give incorrect, misleading, conflicting, or confusing instructions. To do so constitutes reversible error if it is shown that the instructions were erroneous, but they were also prejudicial. I mean, both of these instructions, Dr. Schwartz was prejudiced because his witnesses were not allowed to be considered, and he was prejudiced because the jury was not told what factors would apply to the evidence that was being presented. I want to talk about some of the evidence then, because we're going to run out of time. But I think one of the critical factors in this case is to understand that the sole duty issue, was did Dr. Schwartz do what a reasonable neurosurgeon would do with his care of Ms. Kostel? Because this was the fourth case, and because Judge Fuller had struggled with these issues, and please understand that I'm not here indicating that I don't think Judge Fuller struggled with these issues mightily and what to do with this panoply of information and to try to make sure everybody got a fair trial, because I believe he did. However, I think that some of the things that he did, a couple of them that I've already mentioned and a couple that I'm getting to, resulted in Dr. Schwartz not getting a fair trial. Because what Judge Fuller did as far as letting evidence in, you know, first he hung a hammer around Dr. Schwartz's neck. He said, basically, Dr. Schwartz to date has never offered an opinion as to the standard of care of a neurosurgeon, and he sat through three trials. It has been my clear ruling, and I'll continue to make it, that if Dr. Schwartz opens the door concerning his neurosurgeries or surgical licensure or things like that, then the door is going to swing wide open. And he made it clear that evidence of other cases, the board proceedings, those things were going to be allowed in. So Dr. Schwartz was prevented from being allowed to show his training, his experience, his knowledge of what the things that he was doing, number one, and then number
two. But his testimony, really, he does go through very clearly why he did certain things and why he recommended this surgery and why he did it this way.
He
does. What else would he need? What other information did you think the jury needed?
What Dr. Schwartz, I mean, if you, and apparently Justice Martin, you read his testimony. If you set his testimony down alongside of the record, what you'll see is that he's relating to the jury what the record is. The jury never heard from Dr. Schwartz or he went to medical school. The jury never heard from Dr. Schwartz that he did his 5-year residency. They never heard from Dr. Schwartz, you know, what kinds of things that he did in that time frame. All of those things could have been done.
But why is it unfair to say that if you get on the stand and tell the jury, I've been trained to this level, I've done this, I've done that, all telling the jury that you're competent, then why isn't it fair to also tell the jury that your license has been restricted in such a way that you can't practice in those areas, except under some very limited circumstances, and that you've got to have more training?
We've got to quickly talk about Martin Moss and Boomsma, and I understand my warning, Chief. Please give me a little bit of deference. I mean, Martin Moss, this court, most of the members of this court handled that case. I mean, that was a case where the doctor was basically accused of rape and repeated rape of multiple patients. And when they got to the civil case, there had been board proceedings where there had been hearings and evidence taken and transcripts made and orders were issued, and that doctor didn't have a license. And yet, the struggle was at trial only whether the one thing that the trial judge let in should have come in, and that was, you're not currently licensed. That's number one. Then we look at Boomsma. And Boomsma, of course, dealt with an expert witness who had voluntarily given up his license, which Dr. Schwartz didn't do, but he had a stipulated agreement with the board. And the other side wanted to point that out in cross-examination. And the court did a 403 analysis and said, you know, this was an issue that had been resolved. There were no findings of fact. There are none here. They want to call this an order of...
The time has expired, counsel.
May I finish my response, or do I need to quit, Your Honor?
That's a response to a question.
I thought it was. I was trying to.
That was a long answer.
Okay.
Wind it up.
Yes. If I can just wrap up, if you review the issues in the brief and look at the fair trial issues, it's clear that Dr. Schwartz did not get a fair trial in this case. We'd ask you to find that the errors were prejudicial and to reverse. Thank you,
Mr. Brown. Mr. Goodsell, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice and the court, and may it please the court. It's always interesting with the forcefulness of counsel's arguments, and it reminds me of the story of the three umpires that were discussing how they call the balls and the strikes. And the first umpire says, I call them the way I see it. And the second umpire said, I call them the way they are. And the third umpire, a little more age, says, they ain't nothing till I call them. And all the arguments that counsel is making here, those are not anything other than arguments until this court calls or makes a decision. And the decision to make in this case is an important decision. It starts with, and if we talk about the case, there's a different perspective, is that Trish Costell went in to have one level of her back fused. The doctor went to the wrong spot. He destroyed and then had to fuse the above level, the 3-4. Then he didn't put it into his record as to why he had to go there. And that's a discussion that was touched upon earlier, because then he changed his notes about 2 weeks later after Dr. Tuber and some others said, well, why were you there? Then he had to do the 4-5, what he was supposed to do, what she went in to get done. Then he expanded the surgery to the next level, the 5S1. And there was a pars defect, which is generally considered to be a congenital defect. It's the little flange on the vertebrae that just cracks. And there was nothing wrong with the disc itself. It was a healthy disc. And he takes and does a complete fusion at that level. Unnecessary. Not called for. Then he takes... And after he's gone through these three levels, he has to glue them together. And they do that with bone or cages. And then they have to take rods, put screws into the disc, and put the rods in, and then mount the screws to the rods to hold it in place until the bone tissue in between where they've taken the disc out can heal and fuse it. And when he put the rod in, he left the rod too long on the top side, and it went into the 2 and then the 1. And the patient's entire back then collapsed. And she now has, and at the time of trial, a fusion from her tailbone to the middle of her shoulders. And so this doctor, in one operation, was able to go to the wrong place, then do the right thing, then expand the surgery unnecessarily, and then when he put it back together again, committed the cardinal sin of allowing the apparatus to be so long that it destroyed and went into the rest of her spine. Keep in mind that this is the most important part of the spine. This is where all the weight is on the body and where it's structured. Now, waiting in the wings of this is that there are a series of other cases, and the issues on review are important on those other cases which had now been stayed, and all the issues are going to be the same, and will also be discussed in the Marisol case, which is the next case coming up. Now, one of the things that makes a distinction in this case that's very important is that this is not about a doctor that has the level of competency going in there and doing surgery. This is about a doctor who is not competent and hasn't met the minimum levels of skill and then going in and botching the surgery. Now, there's a two-pronged test, and it was touched in the last part of the discussion here. The first test a professional has to have is, do you possess those skills? The second prong of the test is, did you exercise those skills when you did the surgery? And this is true of all of the learned professions. It's true of attorneys as well as doctors and also priests. It is that the first prong, do you possess, is difficult to obtain. You go through law school, med school. You go through boards and bar exams. You go through proctorships. You get privileges. And once you do that, you can put the name doctor behind your name or lawyer behind your name. And that gives you the presumption then when you hold yourself out and represent the clients, I have the minimum level of skills to practice this profession. This doctor did not possess those. And an issue in this case is what the board ordered when the board determined that he did not possess those skills. So when we break down our arguments, I'm going to come back to this one, we're talking about those things that relate to evidence on the standard of care and the doctor's conduct. Then I want to talk to you a little bit about what they've raised in terms of psychological damages, and then the conduct issues. Breach goes both.
Maybe this is a good time to bring this up. You filed several notice of review issues.
That's correct.
The way I read them, they all go to liability, which I assume if the underlying verdict is affirmed, your issues go away, correct?
That is correct.
All right.
Except for the punitive damage.
You want a new trial on that?
On punitive damage, that's correct.
You have to start all over.
Well, that raises an interesting question, and that's the last part of my argument, Your Honor, but I'm willing to address it right now, is that certainly you'd have to start and look at it again. And the court has always taken a look when you grant a new trial in part and you send part of it back and you're looking at this as to how they're interrelated. And there is the potential to have that. But I think the better argument is that the relationship between compensatory and punitive damages is such that it's a legal relationship in terms of the ratio, State Farm versus Campbell, and this court's already discussed ratios to that extent. That's legal, so I don't see a factual intertwining. I don't see an issue intertwined. However, I understand that that argument may be there. Now, I want to return back then to what we're talking about with this doctor on the stand and his testimony and his expert's testimony. When he takes the stand, and when he also goes to an operating room, is that he takes the name doctor with him. And with that, as a learned profession, there's a responsibility to have a certain level. Now, normally, we don't ever address that in a malpractice case because we don't feel that that's an issue. Most of the time we look at malpractice cases, whether they're legal or whether they're medical, we're looking at a good lawyer, a good doctor, but for some reason, in this particular instance, his conduct falls below the appropriate standard of care. That's not the case here. The case here is the doctor never met the first prong of the test. He appeared to make it. And then while these cases were going on, and this case itself was before the medical board, along with four other cases that we're aware of, and we're aware of that because, and it's in our offer of proof, is that people making the complaints, that's not confidential, and they sent this information to the board. And when the board got this information, the board then initiated the complaint, they followed up with it, then they looked at it, and they set it for a disposition or a hearing on it informally first. Now, those of us that have had opportunity to represent boards, we understand whether we're on the disciplinary board and you're getting recommendations that come to this court, or whether you're on the engineering board or the doctor's board, is that when the board counsel makes a decision to pursue a professional for some type of misconduct, and it's a standard of gross misconduct, is that you line up with your experts, and when that person comes in to account for what he did, is that it's not the board making an inquiry how this happened. It is these experts are saying this is the effect of your conduct. And that's the barrel that Dr. Schwartz was looking at when he had competent counsel with him, and he's looking at the board, what am I going to do? Because the board's saying, we're going to take your license. And this could have been fatal to his career, to which he could never recover. But this board, the medical board, stepped up and did the right thing. They said, you know, you're not competent to practice. You aren't going to practice. We're going to put you on probation. And in this probation, what we're going to do is that, first of all, you're going to waive any rights you have under administrative procedures or any rights to confidentiality. In addition to that, go to paragraph 10, it says it's going to be a public document. And in this public document, it's going to say that you need to have remedial training and education in the two areas that these cases are involved in, the spine, which is radiograph, neuroradiograph, and neurosurgery. And so he had to go back to school. And so this presumption that's given to a professional because he has gone all the way through, as these students are working their way through now, to get to the point where they can be a doctor or a lawyer, no longer cloaks this doctor. And he should have to stand in front of this jury and explain why he admitted in this document that's public that he wasn't qualified to practice, that he needed to go back and have more training.
Are you suggesting solely because he was on probation that per se determines that he does not possess the standard of care that one would expect in a surgeon? How far does this go?
Well, I think when you say you have to go back, it's remedial. It's in the area that you practice in, neurosurgery. That's what you hold yourself out for. You say you can't even practice until you get through going through this retraining clinically, and you can't practice on your own. And then for 5 years, you have to practice. Somebody else is going to be responsible for you. If I was looking at it from a standpoint as just a qualified lawyer, I would say that he was prohibited from practicing, except in a very restricted setting. And that certainly takes down then below the standard that you're going to have as to whether he possessed these skills.
No, exactly.
Anytime you get sued, all the plaintiff's got to do is prove causation and then win.
Excuse me, Judge.
Anytime he gets sued under that scenario, all the plaintiff's got to do is prove causation and they win.
No, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think you go back and look at why we have this privilege, is that this privilege is granted to those that have taken the time to obtain the learned profession. And because that gives us the right to represent the clients, we have that skill. I think it takes away from him the cloak that we normally have for lawyers in good standing and doctors in good standings, and when they step up to do something, that we only look at what occurred in that particular instance. But when the
doesn't this go more to your punitive damages claim?
Yes, Your Honor. Is all this goes in directly to the punitive damage concept because there's a recklessness here that's simply unaccountable for. Now, let me explain that. Is that the four cases that were before the board, the four cases that we talked about, and the cases that are under the 404B issue we talked about here and in our briefs, are cases where the doctor was lost in the patient's spine. He went to the wrong level on the wrong side in the Bobby Gay case, and he admitted it. In the Sowards case, he didn't admit it, but he was on the wrong place. Conlon, he's in the wrong place. That was the case 8 days after this case. Costell, he's in the wrong place. Now, to understand the gravity of being in the wrong place as a neurosurgeon, at first we can say, well, you know, okay, yes, that happens. It doesn't happen. Here's how it happens. Is that once the incision is made, and you're looking at that x-ray, and if you're just wondering why I speak so specifically about this, I have gone through this, and I've watched it, and I've been there, looking down at that spine, and you can't find where you're at. And you look at the x-ray, it says pathology up here, and you can't tell where you're at in that spine. And there's one thing you do. You take out a long needle pin, you lay it across into the cavity, and you take an x-ray. And you take that x-ray, put it side by side along with pathology, and you can see exactly where you need to go. There's no doubt. That was not done in this case. It wasn't done in the other case. And it's such an elementary step that it cannot be excused. Even if we go to the trades, and there's a saying, if you're a tailor, what do? You measure twice and you cut once.
But didn't you argue all this to the jury? Weren't you allowed to do that?
We could not argue the punitive damage. because I was excluded.
But the fact that you were just talking about, the jury obviously saw all that and heard testimony about that.
That's correct, and that's why they brought back a verdict of negligence against the doctor.
Well, you know that as a trial judge, you try to make a fair trial for both sides. And it seems to me that that's what Judge Fuller was doing here. He was balancing, obviously, the severe prejudice that would come in. But did he ever balance it under a 403 analysis?
No.
He didn't do
because
that.
Because I think you're going to a 403 analysis, and we've been accused of trying to, you know, talk about the character of Dr. Schwartz and talk about these issues, is that I'm talking about conduct. I'm talking about conduct that relates specifically to my patient and her experience. And we're talking about, in the 404Bs, other related acts, we're talking about precisely the same thing, being lost in a person's spine because you didn't measure.
So, Mr. Goodsell, are you asking for a remand trial on the issue of punitive damages where the prior bad acts relating to these other surgeries that you suggest were similar in negligence all come into evidence to address the willful wanton misconduct issue?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, because I think it addresses the recklessness, and I think it also is important that it be exemplary. I think the board has taken the first step in making this public. Boards don't have to make these issues public, and lots of times they don't. But in this case, they did. And this is not just a stipulation. This is a consent order. That means that the order is done with the consent of the adverse party. And it is also done in the process is that if that's not sufficient, it also constitutes an admission by this doctor specifically as to the skills he possessed when he went into the surgery.
Is there any precedent for that sort of thing?
In terms of the allowing this prior acts in
yes.
Well, yeah, if you go take a look at the Martinoff case, the doctor there in that particular case, and that's the one that counsel made reference to at the last, in that case is that he no longer was licensed, and the court said, that's fair.
Have we ever reversed a case for just trying it on the punitive damages issue?
I don't think so,
bifurcate it?
I don't think so. And I have to say, with some trepidation.
We're on the internet, so hang close.
Thank you. I have to say with some intrepidation that I am not interested in retrying this case, and neither is my client. It is a long ordeal, and we feel that notwithstanding the trial court's very narrow purview of our cross-examination of this doctor and his experts, we still prevail. But on the other hand, is that we feel that on the issue of exemplary damages, that this doctor should be accountable because of the conduct we have.
I don't know how you do that, though. Do you re-impanel the old jury, or do you start all over with a new jury?
I think you have to start all over with a new jury, Your Honor.
Okay.
And if you look at the case law, it talks about how the issues are intertwined. And I think it's intertwined in terms of factual basis because it's kind of a step backwards. First, you know, exemplary damages, then you have compensatory damages, then you have issues of causation, then you have standard care issues. And if those are also commingled, then it's going to be the decision of the court that I can't get there, you know, in terms of punitive damages without reversing on the entire amount. But I'm suggesting that the court can look at this.
On liability and damages?
Am I suggesting that they look at that? I prefer not to, Your Honor. But I understand their application to my request. Is that when I request, you know, that the court reverse on punitive damages, it may well open up that issue. Nevertheless, that's my request. But I think the court can, in this case, very clearly carve out, because the standard of care is entirely different than the issue that's going to look at on punitive damages.
Remind me what the trial court found and why he did not let the punitive damages issue go forward.
Well, that's interesting because we had a hearing on it and we brought in expert witnesses and did a lot of this because at that time, in my recollection, we had not had the order from the board come down yet. So in large part, we were establishing a parallel peer review on the competency of the doctor to establish that he didn't have professional skills. And we went through all that, and Judge Fuller ruled and simply said, I'm not going to allow the punitive damages to come in.
So when did this order come down, or this agreement?
Well, I can give you the date.
It was before the trial.
Yes, it was before the
trial. So did you renew your motion for punitive damages?
Oh, yes, we renewed the motion for punitive damages.
But you didn't have any more hearings, or just did you?
No, we did
just
not.
An offer of proof, and the court ruled the same way?
That's correct.
No reason particularly? Or?
Well, I don't want to misspeak for the judge, but my perspective on it is that we were very clear as to what he ruled, as to why, is that there wasn't a delineated opinion, at least in the record, nor was there a written opinion on that.
I don't want you to run out of time, and I am interested in one question. If we affirm the verdict in this case, how do you address the issue that's raised by the defendant about the psychiatric testimony and the inability to cross-examine witnesses about multiple personality disorder, blackouts, and her ability to what's been described as the wonderful capacity to enjoy life that you talked about in your closing argument?
I'll address that, Judge. And there's three factors that need to be addressed.
And employer.
And ability.
Loss of enjoyment of life. Correct.
Because I read the jury verdict, and it looks like he got a significant amount of money.
Correct.
On those claims.
And here's the issue on that. There's three issues I need to respond to, Your Honor, with the court's indulgence as to this question. The first issue that they're raising is that she wasn't a candidate. And the second issue is that she would have recovered faster, is that they attempted to bring this information in through their expert. Their expert did not give that written opinion, either in the written opinion under Rule 26.
But they said they couldn't cross witnesses on that either.
Well, certainly you can't cross witnesses on the degree of psychological impairment.
But capacity to enjoy life.
Well, certainly, and I think on the capacity to enjoy life, and I want to switch to that because the two other factors were capacity to enjoy life and related issues and also blackouts. Now, on those issues, they were able to talk with her about her capacity to enjoy, but I want to point out that these were all objective symptoms, and if you look in our arguments in terms of what she could do before, what she could do after, these were physical things that she couldn't do because her spine was frozen from her tailbone in between her shoulder blades, and so it's very objective. And we did not take advantage of that to somehow play on her pain and sympathy and all these issues that sometimes you would, because we deleted that out in terms of emotional infliction. We left that aside and proceeded on objective evidence to show that her life had changed because of this surgery and the results of it. And so that's my response on those issues. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Goodsell. Mr. Brown, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Goodsell, in his argument, did precisely the same thing he did in his brief, and that started with the assumption that the pattern jury instruction that says you've got a duty to have certain knowledge, and then you've got the second duty to perform within the knowledge, is gospel. I would submit that in the last 20 years, that I've been involved with these kinds of cases, that every time a pattern jury instruction gets looked at carefully by this court, that it's often changed. I mean, it happened again in Beef and Packy with an adjustment in the error in judgment instruction, even though it had been adjusted after the Chamberlain and Magbuy kind of thing. That when you find the circumstance that it doesn't fit, then that pattern can no longer live. Where we end up here, and I think that the best case for the court is your decision in Bierstedt. I mean, in Bierstedt, there was no question there about competence. That was an intern who did not have a license, had not had his training, who had an obligation to get supervision from a physician. He took care of a patient, feeling that he was doing okay, and the patient died. And the plaintiff's counsel was saying, this goes to knowledge, it goes to competency, and this court very clearly held that license is not the issue. The issue for the jury is to find out what a neurosurgeon would do, and then what did this doctor do with this patient. And
Does it make a difference that the disciplinary part of this was tied to this particular case?
Your Honor, to decide what was tied to this case is sheer speculation. I mean, Mr. Goodsell, as he indicated, stuck in one of his appendices letters from Dr. Tuber to the board complaining, and he also stuck in the letters from the board to Dr. Tuber that apparently were given then to Mr. Goodsell. And then he stuck in a letter from
Mr. Lose, where Mr. Lose makes a complaint about the next case that we're going to talk about on behalf of his client, Dr. Tuber. I mean, all of those things come up. We have, I think that the important distinction here is between Martin Moss and Boomsma. And in Martin Moss, you had direct findings, testimony, transcripts. The material was found to be not admissible. The statute makes it not admissible. This stipulation is a piece of that same kind of testimony that's statutorily inadmissible. And in Boomsma, you had somebody that was actually testifying as an expert witness, a paid expert. And this court said the simple fact that he reached an agreement with the board and gave up his license, that's not something that ought to be considered.
Now, did you just object to that part of it, or did you actually offer a different jury instruction?
On which part, Your
Honor? On the skill, the two-part.
We offered the pattern instruction that had the second portion. That the testimony of lay witnesses can be considered for those things that they would do.
Well, but where he agreed that the basis for the supervision was malpractice, isn't that a component of whether he went into that operating room on that day and exercised the requisite skill?
No.
Not even a component?
No.
Why is it totally irrelevant?
No. No more than the fact that the intern in Bierstedt was unlicensed.
How about if I showed up there with a law degree that day and tried the surgery? Isn't the jury entitled to know that I got a law degree instead of a medical degree?
I get punitive damages, too.
Thank you.
Not that I'm contemplating this right in my career, but I mean...
I mean, what the other side is doing, Chief, is asking you to speculate on what actually happened. And I mean, I'm sitting there saying, okay, let's speculate. If we're going to speculate, you've got a doctor that has this pile of junk being mounted against him that he has to continue to defend, and he says, I have to do something. I can't continue to pay all of these bills. If we want to speculate. But that's why this court hasn't permitted those kinds of things. What's important is Dr. Schwartz was a neurosurgeon. There's never been any issue here that he wasn't licensed as a physician, that he wasn't trained as a neurosurgeon, and that he wasn't appropriately in town. That's not the issue. The issue becomes whether his performance in her care was appropriate.
But it also appears that based on the chronology of the way the events happened here, that he was not competent to perform this surgery at the time he did, at least based on the board, based on his agreement with the board.
His agreement with the board was that the investigation, the depositions, the stuff would all cease if he would agree to these conditions.
To go back to school to learn how to do it.
Well, to go back to a fellowship, which is additional training in neurosurgery, and specifically one in neuroradiology. I mean, the board was concerned.
Both of the issues that were involved here.
Pardon me?
He needed retraining on both of the issues that were involved here.
How to read
x-rays, essentially. And how to know where you are on the spine.
He satisfied the board's inquiry that the allegations were made that he couldn't do these things by agreeing to get additional training. The board was satisfied with that. The board then, by the time this trial came up, had provided a letter to Dr. Schwartz that indicated that his license was in full standing, that he was in compliance with everything that was there, and that he was free to take his board certification exams. I mean, that's the circumstance that was sitting here.
What's the difference here between an ordinary witness in a malpractice case being able to tell the jury that one doctor is not board certified and the other one is? That's a different degree of licensure.
Yes.
Nobody's going to argue that's unfair game.
I would agree with that.
What's the difference between saying that your licensure is probationary until you get trained on how to do it and a full license that's unrestricted?
That wasn't the circumstance at the time that Dr. Schwartz treated Ms. Costa. That wasn't the circumstance that was presented then. I mean, if we're going to get into the position where we're sitting there saying, I have agreed to allow this probation to take place and I've agreed to take training and everybody is happy, that then says that proves that I'm incompetent.
Yeah.
Then we have ignored the whole cause aspect of malpractice or any other tort, because then we've gotten to where Bierstedt was. that simply not having a license doesn't harm a thing. The question is did Dr. Schwartz do the appropriate thing?
But since the judge did not allow any of that testimony in, how were you even prejudiced by that jury instruction?
Pardon me, Justice?
Well, in my understanding, the judge didn't allow any of that in about his disciplinary proceedings.
He did not.
So how are you prejudiced by this jury instruction?
No. You're misunderstanding what part I'm arguing about there, Justice Meyer. What I'm arguing about is just Dr. Schwartz wasn't even allowed to describe his training experience.
All right.
And he was prejudiced there. He was prejudiced by the instruction on the other end that didn't allow all of his evidence to be considered. Punitive damages was raised in my opponent's argument and also with this court. I think that what this court has to take particular note of is that the standard...
2 minutes.
Yeah. That's why I decide I better get here. We're not going to get there, Justice. Thank you. 21.1.4.1, that before a punitive claim can be submitted to the finder of fact, the court shall find after a hearing and based upon clear and convincing evidence that there's a reasonable basis to believe that there's been willful wanton or malicious conduct on the part of the party claimed against. And they submitted in their appendices their quote offer of proof. And what did it contain? Some of the things that we've talked about here today. Several letters from Dr. Tuber or lawyers representing Dr. Tuber. And then the leaps in logic that this is the same as this and is the same as this, and we're there. And then they submit a letter from a doctor that Judge Fuller considered, who's long retired in Rapid City, who'd never practiced neurosurgery, who wanted to testify on the element of intent, that this is what must have been intended by this neurosurgeon at this point in time. And Judge Fuller looked at that stuff and specifically made the finding that it's not there. Now, this court has given great deference to the trial judges in looking at that kind of evidence to decide whether there is even a punitive claim. And I submit that there is no reason to overrule Judge Fuller's decision on the punitive damages issue here, that there was inadequate evidence. In conclusion, I want to again go back to where we started this thing, and that is we have a doctor who does have to face the allegations made against by individual patients, that he's entitled to a trial, and that's all he's before this court asking for, that he's entitled to have a jury appropriately instructed so that they can decide whether what he did with this patient met the standard of care, and he's entitled to put in appropriate evidence, and he's not, the other side is not entitled to do what they have attempted to do even in argument here today, and that is put in evidence simply to make it appear that Dr. Schwartz's character gives him a propensity to do those kinds of things.
Your time has expired. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.